Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Dan Force. I'm from behalf of UT Arlington and political Mexican-American Politics, Political Science 4319. Let me welcome you here. Thank you for making it across the ice.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
My team members are Kelly Willis and William Tams. And as you pointed out, we're going to start with some biography questions, but we may go ahead and get through that to get to a little bit more of the current questions. If there is something that we missed, but you want to make sure that that it gets pointed out, please feel free to add that to it. Can you tell us a little about where you were born and where you grew up?
I was born in West Texas in a town called Pecos, Texas. It's right off the Pecos River, about 90 miles west of Midland, Odessa area, about 80 miles south of Carlsbad, New Mexico, if y'all know where Carlsbad Caverns is, and about 200 miles east of El Paso. And my parents were also born there. My grandparents were also born in the West Texas area. And I have one great-grandparent that was also born in West Texas. But I feel pretty comfortable in saying that my ancestors are of Mexican descent, whether they've been in the West Texas area or, you know, fifth generation, sixth generation, I'm not sure, but somewhere or another we speak Spanish, and obviously we're from Mexican descent.
When were you born?
When? Mm-hmm. August the 7th, 1961. That would make me 41 years old, I think.
We were going to try to avoid asking you that specifically, but okay.
Uh-huh. I said you were about 37.
Yeah, that was our guess. Did you grow up as far as elementary school, junior high, and high school, all in West Texas also?
In Pecos, yes.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your grandparents and your parents were all from West Texas. Do you know how they arrived there?
No, I've been trying to research that, and it's very difficult to find birth certificates and things of that nature. But, okay. So no, I don't.
What were your parents' names?
Lavario. My father's last name is Lavario. My mother's last name is Tercero.
How do you spell that?
L-E-V-A-R-I-O.
Oh, no, no. That one we've got.
Okay.
Your mother's last name.
T-E-R-C-E-R-O.
What did your brother do?
Nothing.
What did your mother do? I mean,
my parents have an eighth grade education. My father grew up working in the oil business. That is, he was a guy that worked on the actual laborers that brought up the oil from underground. But my father had a lot of trouble keeping a job because he's an alcoholic. He still is. I saw him for Thanksgiving. He's still busy drinking.
Do you know what your grandparents did?
Yes, his dad was a carpenter, and one of my uncles, his brother's a carpenter, another is a realtor that moved to Ensenada, Mexico.
And what were your grandparents' names?
Benita and Saturnino Levario. Those are my paternal grandparents. My maternal grandparents that I never met are Fermina and Vittorio Tercero.
Are you currently married?
Yes.
Do you have any children?
No.
What was your education like in West Texas?
Well, it was, when I was growing up, things were still pretty segregated. They were more so for my parents, but it was interesting because we moved a few times, and my grades directly reflected which school I was going to. And so if I went to the east side over across the tracks where all the Mexicans lived, and for some reason my grades were pretty low. But when we would go to the schools where the white kids went to, then I would be on the honor roll. And so my father decided that he was going to buy a home in a district where you can go to the white schools. And it was a very like a $10,000 house, but that's all he could afford. So that was to my benefit because I started the sixth grade we bought a house when I was in sixth grade, and from then on I went just to white schools, and so I was on the honor roll for the most part.
You believed you received a better education at the white schools?
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah.
And you said something interesting. You said that the segregation was also partly due to your father. Was there a cultural?
No.
Okay.
There was more segregation, of course, when my parents were growing up.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say. And I learned about it through my father.
Okay. You remember the first time that any acts of segregation or prejudice were practiced against you when you were going to school? It was an early?
Well, the one that was very painfully obvious was when they determined who was on National Honor Society in high school. And for some reason, my friend and I were left off of the list. And she went to investigate, and all of the Hispanic students, all of the Mexican American students that qualified to be on the National Honor Society were left off the list accidentally. Mm-hmm. And so that was pretty obvious, and if none of us had said anything, then, you know, it would have been left at that. But there was about 12 of us that were left off of the list, and we finally got back on it. Another thing that I did when I was in high school, I wanted to be, for some reason, I wanted to be on the annual staff. And so, you know, I said, hey, let me be on the annual staff. Well, you can't, because the people that are on the annual staff vote to allow who they're going to allow in on the annual staff. And so, you know, there have always been just white folks on the annual staff. And so I made a big stink, and I got a petition going, and I met with the principal and got the way that the annual staff was selected change. Now, that wasn't obviously racist, but I mean, closed society like anything else. It shouldn't have been, because it was a public school. But
right. Now, did you eventually get on the staff?
No. Hmm. They didn't institute it till a year later, and then I wasn't interested anymore.
Okay. Were there, did you have any sisters or brothers when you were growing up?
Uh-huh.
Okay, what were their names?
Gloria Lavario and Ruben Lavario. And much later, 14 years after I was born, Gabriela Lavario.
Now, they were all younger than you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes.
Between you and your youngest sibling, how many years are there?
Let's see. It's me, and then my brother is 4 years younger than me, and then Gloria is 5 years younger, and then Gabby is 14 years younger.
So almost an entire generation. Did you notice any difference in the way her development, your youngest sister, grew up compared to your own?
Yes. The three oldest ones learned to value education because my father, the alcoholic, instilled the value of education. If we didn't make the honor roll, then we would be punished. I mean, my parents didn't believe in hitting us, so we never got hit, but we would be grounded if we didn't make the honor roll. By the time my youngest sister was born, my mother had kicked my dad out of the house, and which made her grow up in a much more relaxed environment, less stress. However, that led to her being pretty lackadaisical about studying, and all of the adult kids were out of the home by then, and so she is working at Walmart as a cashier now, and isn't going to college, and doesn't seem to need to go to college. So that's, I don't know if that
that's growing up as the eldest child, did you find yourself being protective of your younger brother and younger sister? Were they in school with you?
No, I wasn't protective of them, but I did do a lot of functions as far as motherly functions. They didn't like me a lot because we'd go grocery shopping and they'd want to get cereal that was just sugar, and I'd say, no, we have to get the stuff that didn't have all the sugar. I mean, you know, just things like that, because my mother was working or, you know, not around.
This may seem like a simple question, but I would believe you're a registered voter.
Yes, I'm a registered voter.
Okay. And do you have any particular religious faith or background?
Okay, well, that's two different questions. Yeah, I was raised a Catholic, and I participated fully as a Catholic as I was growing up.
Mm-hmm.
I was even given the award of Eagle of the Cross Award when I was in high school because of my involvement in the Catholic Church.
Now, what is that award?
I can't remember.
Okay. And today, are you a practicing Catholic? Or
no.
Changed?
No, I don't practice any religion.
Okay. Did you find that the Catholic religion was intertwined or tied with the Mexican-American culture? Or in your experience?
Well, at the time that I was growing up, I didn't know of any other thing. That was just my life, my world. Of course, there were Anglos that were Catholic, but yeah, mainly all of the Hispanics were Catholic. And it would be odd to the very close family friend of ours is not a Catholic. She's a Hispanic and she's a Baptist. And we right. thought it was kind of odd, but it's not that big a deal.
Right. And that's kind of where I was headed. In West Texas, there's a huge Baptist presence, and there was never any type of outreach done to your community by the Baptist?
Not that I was aware of, no.
Yeah, where did you go to college?
Texas Tech University in Lubbock, Texas.
And how was that life?
Was it interesting. It certainly opened my eyes to different people. There are people from all over the world there, and I studied things and learned things that I never was aware of, and so I really liked that part of it.
And what did you study there?
Political science and sociology.
And was life like different from like the transition from high school to college? Did you encounter some of the maybe racism or anything like that, or were you welcomed? Or
there was no blatant racism, no, that I experienced. No.
Were you a member of any activist groups while you were at school?
Yeah, let me. Yes. The United Mexican American Students, UMAS.
Okay. And what did you gain from that experience?
Just friendship. I can't remember us being that political over there. I really can't.
Not a whole lot of political activism.
No, not really.
At that point, were you thinking about becoming a lawyer, or what were your aspirations?
I thought about becoming a lawyer since I was a kid, since my father had told me that's what I was going to be, as an attorney.
Your father told you that's what you're going to be?
Uh-huh.
Did you ever question that?
No, it's not like a good idea to me, so.
Okay.
You have to understand, I was raised with an extreme sense of justice because of my father would... that's all we would talk about is politics in Pecos, and about how much racism there was against Hispanics and blacks and poor folks, and so we were raised in that environment, and so my father's idea was the only way to take care of those things was to become an attorney, because attorneys can do that, and so his goal was for me to become an attorney and then come back and fix everything.
Was there any professors that stuck out in your mind from your education that kind of, made you want to, influenced you at any point?
No.
Your education?
No. I can't think of any.
Was there anything else significant going to Texas Tech that would have pushed you further in that direction, or were you just already pretty much decided to become a lawyer?
I pretty much just said, there weren't any professors saying, hey, Lena, what do you want to do? Can I help you do what you want to do? No, there's nothing like that. I mean, it's massive. There's 200,000 students, and no, there was no professor that took me into his way.
Where did you go to law school?
At Texas Tech University.
Oh, yeah. And when did you graduate from law school?
1986.
And when did you make the state bar?
1986.
Practicing for 17 years.
Right.
Who was it that appointed you state district judge?
Ann Richards, Governor Ann Richards.
And was it her or someone more locally that influenced you to take that position?
Someone more locally, the word had gotten out that Governor Richards wanted to appoint a Hispanic. She had already appointed a Jewish attorney. She had appointed a Jewish judge, a gay judge, and now she was looking for a Hispanic. And so Judge John Cruzo, who was also appointed by Governor Richards, encouraged me to put my name in the hat. He's an African-American judge. And so I did.
Okay. And what was that process like? I mean, how did you go from having your name in the hat to a selective process to being notified that you were their candidate?
Well, it was an interesting process. You submit your name and you fill out a 50-page application form. And then you're interviewed by people that are on some sort of informal committee for the governor. And it's basically folks that have contributed to her campaign and folks that are familiar with the legal profession. And so I met with a couple of influential people here in the city. And there was also some other candidates, another Hispanic candidate that was also being considered. And then I got the word that I got the appointment.
Okay, so there were a couple of interviews and then, and who notified you?
Well, someone from the governor's office on the telephone.
Did you ever meet personally with Governor Richards?
Not until recently, no.
What was that like?
Oh, it was fun. I love Governor Richards, even though I've never met her before. I've read a lot about her and heard her speak, so it was an honor for me to meet her. And when I told her who I was, what happened was that I ran again for judgeship this past year. She came down to help us campaign, and when I introduced myself, I said, "Governor Richards, you don't know me, but you made me the first Hispanic female judge in this county." And she says, "Yeah, I know who you are. Are you running again?" And I said, "Yeah, I am." And she says, "Well, give them hell. Don't stop." And then we spent a little bit of time together. She had me laughing all these funny stories. That's just her personality, so it was fun meeting her.
One of my favorite quotes is from her is that politics in Texas is a full contact sport.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is.
Besides your father basically laying out for you that you were going to be a lawyer, were there other influences that drove you to be a lawyer, or how have you found being a lawyer? Are there things that being a lawyer that are obviously satisfying to you personally?
Yes. I like to argue. I was in debate for 4 years in high school. There is a certain amount of conceit that you have to have, or not conceit, what would you call it, when you like yourself a lot or think highly of yourself?
Good self-esteem.
Good self-esteem. That's what both your professor and I have. We have good self-esteem.
It's that dry cereal.
We like to hear ourselves talk. And being a criminal defense lawyer is the best way you can get into trial. And I decided to become a public defender when I got out of school. I actually wanted to be a civil rights attorney, but there's not a lot of work for civil rights attorneys out there. If you go, you'll laugh when you call, "Hey, y'all need a lawyer in your firm?" That's not the way it works. They don't have firms that just do civil rights. They're not out there anxiously hiring civil rights attorneys. So I decided to be a public defender, and that was a lot of fun because I was in trial every day almost, and I've got a lot of practice being in trial, and I was really good at it. I'd win most of my cases, and it was just a lot of fun. In the meantime, of course, you're providing a good service to people that don't have money to hire an attorney, and so it was really a good experience. The public defender's office was a really good place for me to get started.
And where you were a public defender, was that for the city of Dallas or?
The county.
The county of Dallas. Mm-hmm. How did you find the experience of being a judge different from being a defense lawyer?
It was so much easier. When you're an attorney for either side, either you're advocating for either the state or for the defendant. When you're a judge, you're not advocating for anyone. You're just there as a referee of sorts, and you make sure that everybody gets a fair trial. And so it was wonderful because you didn't have to prepare. There's nothing to prepare except just know what the law is. And then if you didn't know what the law is, you just call a staff lawyer and say, "Hey, in the middle of a trial and this is a legal issue, what's the answer? And they would look it up for you. And I enjoyed that a lot. It was easier. Of course, it's difficult when the parties decide that they want you to make a decision as to whether somebody's guilty or not guilty and then let you decide what the punishment should be. That's very difficult. Not in that you don't know what to do, it's just stressful, a different type of stress, because when you're an advocate, you know what you're supposed to argue. You know, you argue one side or the other. When you're a judge, you're the one making the decision as to whether or not the state's proven their case, and then if they have, then, you know, how long somebody should go to prison.
When someone gets arrested and they can't afford a lawyer, isn't it a problem in Texas for them to get a lawyer because it takes so long for them to get a lawyer because there's so many people? Is that a problem?
It has been a problem in Texas for a long time. And the problem has been that judges, one of the powers that I had as a judge that every judge has in this state is to name a lawyer, appoint a lawyer to represent someone that cannot afford to hire an attorney. Many times the judges appoint their friends because then the judges turn around and pay the lawyers what they think is good and it comes out of the county budget. And so a lot of judges, instead of appointing folks that are the best qualified to represent folks, they appoint their buddies or they appoint lawyers that they know are just going to move the case, they're not going to make a big fuss and demand trials and slow up the docket.
Do you think that system's good or it should be reformed?
I think it should be reformed, and it has been reformed. We were able to pass some laws this past year. No, it's been a couple of years now that require the counties to come up with a system on appointing attorneys, and they have to be qualified. There's a minimum amount of qualification. Unfortunately, most judges in Dallas County have chose to ignore that and do not appoint lawyers off of the wheel and don't use the system that's been developed, so we're sort of struggling with that.
Can you just give us a brief description of what a state district judge's job entails?
There are many, many district courts in the state, and they all deal with different things depending on which county they're in. But anytime you have a civil case, a criminal case, any type of legal problem, you have to go into a court. There are county courts, which hear usually the less severe misdemeanor cases and in criminal cases, which involve DWIs, which is the worst misdemeanor, I guess, and then simple assaults and things like that, that can only be punished with time in a county jail. And the maximum is usually 1 year. Unless it's a DWI, then the maximum is 2 years. Those are misdemeanors in the criminal court. And those are county courts. District courts hear felony cases, which is anything that can be punished with time in prison, from capital murder and death penalty cases all the way down to third-degree felonies or state jail felonies, which are a maximum of 2 years in the state jail, and then third degrees are 2 to 10 years in prison, second degrees are 2 to 20, first degrees are 5 to 99.
Okay. What was the size of your district? What did it encompass?
It's all of Dallas County.
All of Dallas mm-hmm. County. And was yours criminal or civil?
Criminal.
Since leaving the bench and going back to being, are you still a public defender or?
I'm in private practice now.
Okay. How does that experience influence the way you now practice?
Well, because of my vast experience, I'm able to charge high fees. and because of my name's been out there, then people recognize my name and I'm able to get more clients. But I mean, you know, I fight for my clients whether or not I still get court appointments. The judge is calling me and saying, Lena, we've got a child molester that doesn't speak English, come and do you want this case and represent this guy? Because the number of Spanish-speaking attorneys that practice serious cases is pretty small in Dallas County, and so they have to appoint people that work in the community. The public defender's offices have enough, so.
Okay. Did you have a desire to be a judge anywhere along the line, or was that appointment kind of just when they mentioned it to you, said, okay, that would be...
Well, no, I never had a desire to be a judge. And then when Judge Crizeau mentioned it, I thought, you know, me a judge, really, I mean, I'm not really that qualified. And my husband pointed out how I would come home every day complaining about how ignorant all the judges were, and made me realize, oh yeah, I guess I can't be a judge. Probably be a better judge than all of them. So yeah, I went ahead and did it.
Okay, and you mentioned that you ran again for the judgeship. Your appointment then was because there was a vacancy.
Yeah.
And what made you decide to run for the judgeship this time?
Frustration, again, the Republicans. There have been no, I'm a Democrat.
Right.
There have been no Democrats that have been judges since 1995, which is the last year that I was a judge. They've all been Republicans, and they've all been very comfortable to the point where some of them really don't work that much. When we ask to see their parking records so that we can see when they come into the courthouse and out of the courthouse, they refused to divulge to the taxpayers what their work hours are because of safety reasons. They are very, a lot of them are very states oriented, and because of it, as you know, Texas has gotten a very bad reputation for providing justice. Judges have allowed lawyers in death penalty cases to sleep during the trial, and our Supreme Court, our Court of Criminal Appeals here, says that's perfectly fine. And so the frustration had been building, and so I decided to put my name in the hat, and we convinced a whole bunch of other folks to run as a Democrat. We had 24 Democratic candidates running against the judges here in this county. We came very, very close. I lost by less than a percentage point. And I think that we did a good job of putting some issues out there to whoever wanted to hear about the issues. And I know that the judges were pretty stressed out. They were probably up late at night watching the results come in. And even though they won, I think that there has been some change. And they're not as comfortable as they used to be. My opponent started showing up at 8:30 for court every day, even though in the past he could get there like at 10. So, I mean, you know, just things like that. That's what...
Did any of the 24 candidates that were running, any of them get elected?
None except for one, but she was a Republican. She had been a Republican judge for the three terms before that, and then got booted off by another Republican, so then she decided to run as a Democrat. And so she had a lot of name recognition, and a lot of Republicans did vote for her and voted her back in as a Democrat.
You mentioned Judge Crizeau?
John Crizeau, C-R-E-U-Z-O-T.
Helped getting you nominated, interested. Was there anyone else that helped get you nominated and get you before the governor or the board?
I don't know of anyone. They asked for references, and you know, I put down references.
Are you currently a member of any organizations, obviously the bar, but any other community organizations?
I am on the grievance committee for the State Bar of Texas. We hear complaints against attorneys that they violated any rules of ethical conduct, and I'm the chairman of one of the committees, and that takes up a lot of my time. I am also a member of LULAC, League of United Latin American Citizens. I'm on their Civil Rights Committee, Advisory Committee to the National Group. And I'm soon to be of counsel to LULAC, National LULAC. And I'm on a member of the group called Hispanic 50. It's 50 women that... our mission statement is to educate the community about the economic situation of Hispanic women in the Dallas area, basically. And so all of our functions are geared toward that. We meet with government heads, CEOs, to discuss hiring more Latinas or Hispanic women.
Do you like the system of electing judges that are, the way it's ran through Texas, or do you believe that appointing judges would be a more objective method?
Well, I think a combination is needed, because in the federal system, federal judges get appointed for life, And they have to go through a rigorous process of getting appointed. But once they do get appointed, then it's really hard to remove them from office. You basically have to declare them incompetent or, I mean, it's very difficult to remove a federal judge. And so I think that a combination of appointing judges and then maybe some retention votes, there has to be a way to get rid of judges if they're not doing their job. And so I think that would be a good combination.
And do you currently do any work as a mentor for anyone in your community?
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I mean, it's hard to keep track. I've got two high school kids that come to my office every day for an hour or so. But I've always done that. When I was a judge, I had four, I think, kids coming and working in my office and learning. I represent children in Child Protective Services cases where they're removed from their parents. And I take an interest in them. I also practice juvenile law, where I represent a lot of children that are accused of committing crimes, and I try to mentor them. I don't do all of them, of course, but you know, and I'm just helping a college girl in Denton now work on a paper and try and get her resources and stuff. You know, I just do stuff like that.
Okay. Do you find part of that coming from your own childhood experience, that it sounds like you didn't really have a mentor growing up?
Well, I didn't feel deprived of mentorship, not at all. I always felt when I was growing up that I knew what I was doing, and that when I was in high school, I would mentor other students, and so I never felt the need that for a mentor, but there was always someone there to help me, because I would always feel free to ask someone for help. But I think the reason that I do it is because of the way I was raised.
Right.
My mother was a devout Catholic, and she would always encourage us to be humble and always encourage us to help other people. And so I think that's where I got it, from the church and from my mother and from my father, that the life's goal should be to help others. They can't help themselves.
I have one question. You mentioned that you were on the board of bar grievances?
The State Bar Grievance Committee, yes.
Committee. Was there, you hear grievances from different lawyers?
So, once in a while. The state bar is the agency in the state that gives lawyers their license.
Okay.
And there are laws that say it's what lawyers can and can't do and how they're supposed to act.
Are immigration lawyers bad lawyers, or is there any particular type of lawyer that gets more grievances than others that you've seen?
Criminal defense lawyers get a lot of grievances because, especially the ones that are sitting in prison, sitting on a 30-year prison sentence, trying to figure out how to get out of prison.
Yes.
So they file a lot of grievances against their lawyers to try and get their case reopened. But is there one particular type of law where the lawyers are scummier? No. I mean, either you're scummy or you're not.
Was there a lot of grievances against immigration lawyers, though, probably try to take advantage of people?
I haven't seen the numbers, you know, it just takes a certain personality. The worst guy I remember is a ticket lawyer that would take people's money to do tickets.
Okay.
And would never even show up, and there'd be warrants out for people's arrests. And there's a mother taking her kids to soccer practice that got arrested in Duncanville, and she got handcuffed and her kids got taken away from her because she had warrants for tickets that he didn't handle. So. Yeah, I can't say that necessarily immigration attorneys are worse than the others.
Yeah, it's scum. On the issue of immigration.
Why don't you apologize?
No, scum.
Right, no, that's what I'm saying. Either, I mean,
this is what you're saying. If you're a bad lawyer, you're a bad lawyer. It really doesn't, the expertise doesn't matter. But what do you think, or how do you feel about the amnesty question that's being put up there for the illegal immigrants that are currently in Texas to go ahead and nationalize them or make them citizens, to kind of resolve that illegal immigrant status? What are your feelings on that?
Well, I think the immigration laws in this country are a joke because they're applied differently depending on which country you come from, and there's not a fair way of allowing people to come into this country, and depending on which region you're in, you know, your cases are going to be processed at a different level. On another level, it's a joke because big business, especially here in Texas, want people to come over here illegally and work for them. I think that if all the illegal aliens disappeared from Texas tomorrow, it would have a devastating effect on our economy. And so I think that the U.S. should decide either way, one way or another. Either we're going to have immigration laws and we're going to enforce them, or we're not going to enforce them. And so once that, and as far as I'm concerned, I don't care. It doesn't matter to me, as long as the system is fair and evenly applied across the board. A lot of folks have been allowed to come in here illegally. It can't be that hard to stop people from coming over here illegally. You and I know where all the Mexicans are. They're working in restaurants. They're working at construction sites. If INS wanted to right now, they can go round up everybody and get them out of here, but they haven't been doing that. So the issue has to be resolved, I think, either way. And I think that if we have laws, then they have to be enforced. Obviously, granting amnesty every 15 years encourages people to come over here illegally and try and stay here for as long as possible. Okay. I do have certain problems, if I may say, with parents that come here illegally with their children, or come here illegally and then their children are born here. It's very stressful for the children, and I see that from my work as a CPS attorney and as a juvenile attorney, because of the instability there. And I also mentored a child that whose father was eventually deported because he was selling drugs and had to leave the country. But they were born in Mexico, and they came here, and they graduated. And what we have is kids in high school that are not here legally, that have been in the system this whole time, don't qualify for financial aid, have problems getting into colleges because they don't have a social security number, and it's terrible. And I blame the parents in part for putting the children in that situation. In that sense, yes, I would love it if they would be given amnesty and allowed to stay. But, that's just my opinion for what it's worth.
Right. But you're saying the whole system really needs reform.
Oh, yeah.
In your experience as both a lawyer and a judge, how do you define leadership, either by your own experience or what you've seen?
Leadership, it takes on different connotations depending on what you're talking about. But I think leadership, the leadership that I admire, is people that have sincere beliefs and then do something about their beliefs. There are some leaders in our community that, a lot of leaders, one reason why I don't like politics is a lot of politicians, as you know, are in it just for themselves so they can acquire power and money in different ways. And so that's the type of leadership that I don't like.
Who do you think is the most effective Hispanic politician today?
Effective? Mm-hmm. Able to get things done? Gee, that's a tough one. I should have researched that. Well, you should have given me the heads up before I came here.
Locally
or nationally?
Locally. And you could take it to the state level. I mean, one that you're impressed with. Or if there's not, that's...
National level, if so.
I'm sorry, I have to pass on that question.
On the state level or national level, there's no one that stands up? That's not a state.
I'm just drawing a blank, yeah.
Well, let me ask you about politicians. What about effective leaders?
A lot of the women that are in my group are effective leaders and work every day to make change.
You said your group
is? Hispanic 50.
Hispanic 50.
I've come to know a lot of women that are working within the community to make change, either through education, healthcare, and politics, voting rights, and things of that nature. And I think there's a lot of good people out there, a lot of Hispanics that are working to make changes, including your professor here that has done a lot as far as educating the public and doing his part in making changes in our community, in the past and currently, as you're well aware. But as far as one standout now.
What do you think is the biggest problem for Hispanic women as far as politically and economically?
The biggest problem for Hispanic women?
As far as like advancement?
Well, I think the problem is in general for women and the powers that be. I tend to think that economics has more to do with whether you're going to make it ahead or whether you're not, and more so than race or gender. And so I always encourage when I ask students what they want to be when they grow up, I always encourage them to do something that, where they'll be able to make a lot of money. I mean, I know that sounds bad, you know, because they always say, well, I just want to be happy. It's like, well, you'll be happy if you're rich, you know, and you'll be powerful if you're rich. You can do whatever you want to. And so I really think that for whatever reasons, women, minorities got started behind the starting line, 10 steps behind the starting line, and it's taking quite a while for us to catch up. But I told my husband the other day, I think within 100 years, women will probably be making equal amounts of money to men, if not more, because there's so many more of us that are going to schools, law schools, medical schools, that I think women are ready to take over this country soon, very soon. Maybe not 100. My husband thinks maybe a little more than 50 years. It's coming. What do you think, Professor?
15 years.
15?
That's what I tell the class.
Well,
classes. Well, what's the most pressing issue facing Mexican Americans?
You know, it's easier
for... Let's forget Hispanics here for a little while.
It's easier for Mexican Americans to pass, as they say, to get higher up in the ladder, because, you know, we don't have the color thing, we don't have the black thing, we don't have the... I think the biggest thing against us is our last name, because a lot of us can pass. And so I think there's still a prejudice so that we don't advance. I'm all for affirmative action, because I know all too well how you can get a job, or you can get a job or a position based on who you know, and it's always who you know. You know, and without affirmative action, and it doesn't mean that they're racist, people are racist. I mean, if I'm running a company and there's a position open for the accountant or the bookkeeper or something, I'm going to call my friend and say, hey, you want this job? And I think affirmative action is necessary, so that, because most of the people now that are holding power are Anglos, and they're going to put their friends in those positions. That's what I think. And so that's one of the main reasons that I want affirmative action. I'm for affirmative action, is because it gives other people that have been historically deprived of those positions an opportunity to have them. And so I think Mexican Americans are there, along with African Americans and any other minority group, as far as making progress. But I was in I was in Mexico City this past weekend, and I saw a tour. I was at a museum, and there was a tour guide speaking in Spanish to the kids and about the Mexican American War and how the United States took away half of Mexico's property. And he said, "But not to worry, because we're slowly taking it back," which is true. I mean, the number of immigrants in this country, or Mexican Americans in this state, are astounding, and the rates that they're giving birth to children, I think pretty soon, you know, very soon, then it's going to happen like in Crystal City. You know, it's going to be a Mexican American state in the near future.
What are the underpinnings of tension between African Americans and Mexican Americans today?
Money. You know, it's the same thing. That's the thing that I don't like about politics, local politics, state politics, is you get for your people a means of taking away from other people, you know. And I think it's a stupid way to think of it, but I think a lot of local politicians see it that way. And well, I've been in meetings where, you know, hey, we need to get these jobs, all the blacks over there in that organization, you know, at that county jail or wherever, all the blacks have all those jobs. It's time for the Mexicans. We need to demand that the Mexican Americans get those jobs. I think that the mentality is that there's a limited piece of the pie that minorities can have, and so for some reason Hispanics and blacks feel like they have to be fighting over that small piece of pie. And I think that is, I think there's people working against that, but you know, there's still a lot of blacks that, I mean, I have a lot of friends that are black, and you know, I think that's stupid to say, but I do. But I know that they're racist, you know, they think a certain way about Mexicans, and Mexicans are the same way about blacks. I've had an elected official in my office when I was a judge refer to a black in a derogatory manner, you know. And so it's still out there, and I think in general, to think that only that just white people are racist is wrong. I think African Americans and Hispanics are also racist, and that needs to change, and there needs to be more of a sense that, hey, we're all in this together and let's make things right. And I try to, whenever I'm in a committee or something, I don't try and just get more for Hispanics. My thing is, let's make it even. How can we make it even for everyone? Hispanics, blacks, and don't forget, folks, we've got a huge Asian population that's coming up, and so we need a system in place that deals with all of it, so every time a new minority comes up, we don't have to rehash all of this over again, so.
Okay. Well, you know, when we asked you the question about the Mexican-American politician, you really referred back to the organization, and would it be fair to say that you think that the Hispanic 50 is the most effective political organization right now that you're aware or working with?
No.
Which one do you find to be most effective?
In a certain sense, LULAC is effective as far as putting the issues out there for people to talk about. The Mexican American Legal Defense Fund can be very effective because they have the money to file lawsuits and make changes in court. And so those are, I think, two important organizations, Latino organizations that I think are out there now.
Do you think there are some judges that carry out their own personal agendas instead of interpreting law? And how do you feel about that?
Oh, yeah. Just look at all of the Republicans that have been nominated to fill federal benches.
But with the federal court system, do you think there's any discrimination towards minorities? And if so, do you have any solutions? For example, crack cocaine? And
I think if a minority has enough money to buy a really good lawyer, then they have a better chance of succeeding in court. I think it goes back to the lack of funds thing, where you have to take whichever lawyer you get, or hope that somebody will see that you've suffered such a great injustice that they'll want to take the case on pro bono. So, you know, I think there is discrimination. I mean, if I'm in trial and I've got a guy that's a Mexican, that's a client, and he killed a white person, well, I'm going to try and get as many Mexicans on my jury as I can. You know, not that there's racism involved, but I mean, to win a case, you want to have the jury look at things from your point of view. And the more people that are like my client, the better chance I have of winning a case. They can see things through my client's eyes. So I wouldn't say that that's racist. I would say that's just common sense.
With regards to legislation passed into law, do you think there's racism within Texas law? Or discrimination in any sort?
Not, just ask me right now, no. I don't think there's.
What about the crack cocaine? How much time you have to do?
Well, that is the problem, the powdered versus the crack cocaine. Yeah, that's a good point. For some reason, African Americans or poor folks are more likely to use crack cocaine. Rich folks would be more likely to use powdered cocaine and less likely to go to prison. I think it goes back to rich and poor. I've got a client, if in federal court, if you steal $2 million from a bank, the most that you can get is 5 years in prison, okay? And I've got a client now that stole about a couple of million. I'll probably be able to get him 3 years in prison, okay? Now, I have another client in federal court that sold 7 boxes of Sudafed to somebody. Now, why would he sell Sudafed? Well, you make methamphetamine with Sudafed. So he legally purchased Sudafed, turned around and sold them to some guy that said he wanted to sell it in California, so he says. The minimum that he could get was 25 years in prison. So if you're a white collar person, I mean, you can get away with, stealing millions from people and not do any time, but if you do something that's, you know, more associated with what poor folks do, use drugs and stuff like that, and you can go to prison for a long time. And speed, I think, is used more by white poor folks than blacks or Hispanics. So.
You feel that way from your experience from working with the being an attorney and a judge.
That poor folks have to get it, yes. You know, get it worse than, okay. than rich folks.
Do you feel you've been able to affect any changes, both an attorney and a judge in the Hispanic community?
I don't know. I think just by being a presence, the people are less likely to do stuff. I mean, you know, if you're the only Hispanic at a table with a bunch of judges and they're making policy decisions, then small things, and yeah, you're effective. I remember one time we had to hire a court reporter for the drug court, and there was a young African-American female that wanted the position, but she had absolutely no experience. And there was an Anglo female that wanted the position, and they're all women, you know, all the court reporters for some reason, and then no guys want to be court reporters, I don't know why, but they're all women. She had been around for, 40 years being a court reporter, and she wanted the job as well. The people on the committee deciding who the court reporter was, me and Judge Larry Baraka, he's an African-American, and then an Anglo female, Judge Warder. And Judge Baraka and I decided that the woman that had absolutely no experience, the young one, was going to get the job. And Judge Warder had a problem because she said it was ridiculous. The other woman clearly had all of the experience and was entitled to the job. But our position was that, yeah, she has all the experience because she got all that experience in the first place because she's an Anglo female. So all of the court reporters in this courthouse, if you notice, are Anglo females. So it's time to open this baby up. We're going to give it to the no experienced African-American female, and she had a white woman that was helping her, also a misdemeanor court reporter. She was Anglo female, and she had told us, yeah, I will help her if she has any problems. I know her, she's a good kid. I helped her get through school, and I will mentor her if she has any problems. So we gave it to her. So, small things like that. When I was a public defender, all of the non-English speaking people had to wait in jail a month longer than the English-speaking folks because there weren't enough, Spanish-speaking probation officers or interviewers to get them out faster. And so I just, sent a letter threatening to file a lawsuit, and they fixed it. They started hiring more Spanish-speaking probation officers. And, small stuff like that. But, nothing big. I haven't.
Judge, you mentioned that you might be of counsel to LULAC.
Yes.
Would you tell us how that is developing, if you can, and what you would do if you are such a person?
LULAC has attorneys that they use to advise them on different issues. And the new president of LULAC is based here in Dallas. The national president of LULAC is based here in Dallas, and I've known him for a few years. And so basically what the job would entail is that they name you up counsel, and whenever they want to consult with you about different legal issues, then they give you a call and say, what do you think about this, or what do you think we should do in this situation from a legal standpoint? And so that's the extent of it.
In class, we've discussed LULAC, and we've discussed some recent developments, LULAC being against Mayor Miller and LULAC being in favor of Miguel Estrada's nomination in the Fourth Circuit.
Mm-hmm.
Any comment or opinion about either or both?
Well, since I'm not their lawyer yet, part of the thing about being a lawyer is you don't have opinions as far as politics. You just give legal advice and that's it. But I think from LULAC's point of view, they're supporting Mr. Estrada because he's Hispanic and they want more Hispanics regardless of what their views are. And I know that LULAC, especially the current president, Hector Flores, has gone out of his way to try and bring in more Republicans into the organization. Because he feels that LULAC should express just more than one point of view, and so. But as one of my favorite commentators said, the only reason that the Bush administration is putting Estrada out there is because he's Hispanic, and even though Bush says he's against affirmative action, that's affirmative action. If he weren't Hispanic, they wouldn't have even been considering him because he lacks the qualification and refuses to tell anyone what his legal opinions are on different issues. So. If you, without looking at the name, then yeah, he's a lousy candidate. And the only reason he's out there is because he's Hispanic, and I think that's the only reason LULAC is supporting him, is because of his last name. So, and what was the other issue? The Laura Miller.
Mayor Miller.
I hate that kind of politics. The reason they don't like Mayor Miller is because she blamed the Dallas's situation
on Ted
Benavides.
And Bolton,
and then the other Jose Plata, right, over at the visitors, the convention.
No, Luna.
Chris Luna. I'm sorry, yeah. Jose Plata's with the school board.
Was. Now we have Mr. Anchia, Super Duper Anchia.
Right, and so I don't think it's right just to go against somebody because she's trying to get rid of people that she thinks are lousy people and shouldn't be there. But the question is, yeah, does that mean that she's necessarily racist? I mean, should we keep someone in power that's lousy just because they're a minority? And so, you know, I don't know whether LULAC should be, I mean, they basically came out and called her a racist, and I don't know if there's enough evidence there to say that she's a racist. But you know, that's politics. He's got his reasons, right, for doing that, I guess.
We've got about 3 more minutes. You guys got anything or anybody else? There's some questions.
You keep saying he. What is your husband's name and what does he do?
My husband's name is Mark Matos, M-A-T-O-S. His father was born in Panama. My husband's oldest sister was born in Panama, but he was born here. His mother is a tall white lady from Tulsa, Oklahoma. And he is an engineer with Cisco Systems. He's not an attorney. And I met him at Lubbock. I've been married to him for 20 years. And we have no children.
No question.
My name is Pam Bass. Thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
You're not a judge presently.
Correct.
And you haven't been a judge since 1995.
Correct.
But are you still addressed as judge?
Yes.
Okay. And I heard on the radio this morning coming to school about somebody that's bringing up another case because not enough blacks on the jury.
Yes.
You heard about that?
Uh-huh.
What is your opinion about that?
That's been a big problem. Yes, it has been a big problem. Actually, specifically the case, it's a U.S. Supreme Court case, and so not only the juries, but the grand jury. The way you select a grand jury is really bad because, again, the judge appoints his friends to select friends that he knows in the community to put them on the grand jury. And so even though issues with the discrimination and jury selection have been dealt with, and that was a U.S. Supreme Court case that says, yes, you have to make sure that the jurors are selected and are not discriminated against because of their race, because they have a right to serve if they want to serve. And also a big issue is the selection of the grand jury. But you're referring to the recent U.S. Supreme Court case, right?
It was something about a jury has to be of your peers.
Yes.
And if this defendant was African-American and there were no African-Americans on the jury, so they were saying that there was not anybody on the jury that was his peer.
Right.
So they're bringing it up again.
The issues involve prosecutors. Right. The issues involve whether or not there's any African-Americans or in the pool to begin with. And then if there are in the pool, then the prosecutors, just what I was telling you earlier, you try and get rid of the people that don't think like your guy. Prosecutors do the same thing. If they see that my client is black and the victim is white, the prosecutors are going to try and get rid of all the blacks on the juries. But the recent law says they have to come up with a good reason before they can do so. And what the Supreme Court says is now just having a good reason isn't enough. Now, if you have a reason, you have to apply that for all. Let's say you got rid of the black person because he had facial hair and you don't think that people with facial hair should serve on a jury. Well, if you left white folks on with facial hair, then what you did here was just a covering for what you really meant to do. And so the Supreme Court decided that the defense has a right to litigate those issues and determine whether or not truly the strike was because of racial issues or non-racial issues. So that's the latest case.
Judge Lavario, thank you so much for your time and your candidness. We appreciate you being here today. I don't think we have any more time, though we probably have 100 more questions, but thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, guys. I really enjoyed it. Thank you so much.